Tonight it is our intention, my intention I suppose, more concretely to move forward with our study of the categories of the Old Testament, an overview, a big picture of the Old Testament. And next in line is the second to last, I suppose, a grouping of the time before Jesus is coming. The last is an interesting one. The second to last, I suspect, is also an interesting one. Two time periods that we don't study a lot. This one being the post-exilic time, or post-exile, that is, after exile. It's like a pre-game show is before the game, right? A post-game show is after the game. And so this would be after the exile. And as we're talking about it, we've got some images here, swords and tools on the same page. It's an interesting concept, but one that becomes important as we come back from the exile that God had rightfully put the Israelites in. If you remember back to our study in the exile, and even pre-exilic times, the divided kingdoms, we saw an overwhelming abundance of iniquity. And the challenge for the Israelites was to stay faithful regardless of what was frequently bad kings. People who were leading the Israelites weren't good people and doing good things. And so there was a chastisement that was to come. As we read there in Jeremiah, a 70-year captivity or a 70-year time period where they would be under the thumb of the Babylonians, the king of Babylon. Not only Nebuchadnezzar, but his son, and arguably his son's son. And then, as we talked about a few weeks ago, when Daniel was counting up the numbers, I love that imagery. It's almost like many of the Israelites, and that's effectively what happened. 70 years is a long time. Even the 56 or 58 years that they were literally in captivity is a long time. That's two generations worth of people. And Daniel, it's almost like something spurs him on to begin counting. And thankfully, he can count higher than 20 with his shoes off. So he goes ahead and starts the counting of the days from the time that it would begin. And he determines appropriately that it has been long enough. It has been the 70 days or the 70 years. And he begins to pray. What you have at a similar time is a man named, you have a man named Cyrus, to whom is brought the information concerning this prophecy of himself, as we talked about before, and the prophecy predicts that he would release God's people, that he would send them back on their way and support them in what needed to be done. And in 538, so he does. So we look at the timeline. Again, the post-exilic period is about rebuilding. If you're paying attention, I forgot to mention that. If I had to pick a word, it would be to rebuild, because they need a lot of rebuilding. There's a number of things that have been destroyed, a number of things that the Israelites put their faith and their trust in. The Israelites, before the Babylonians showed up, they put their faith in the walls. Nebuchadnezzar destroyed those walls. And then they put their faith in the temple, and Nebuchadnezzar destroyed the temple. And they put their faith in their worship to God, and Nebuchadnezzar put an end to the worship of the God of heaven and earth for the time, at least the official services that would go on at the temple. And that was in 597 BC is when Nebuchadnezzar actually shows up. They are a puppet to the Babylonians for several years before that. But in 597, he shows up. And in 538, Cyrus, king of Persia, releases them. And during that period, many things happen. Many books are written, among them being Ezekiel and Daniel, and half of Jeremiah, and parts of other books. But in 538, you feel almost like things are supposed to change. Like the Israelites are given a new hope, a second chance to do things right. And if you look, that bar seems really long. But it's only about 120 years before the time of exile, the post-exilic. And I suppose the post-exilic period would go, I mean, pretty far after exile. But the time where God speaks to them, the time where God is communicating with the Israelites overall, it doesn't last very long. If we look at the facts of the post-exilic period, when we say post-exile, of course, we mean after the 70-year captivity, after the 70 years that they were under the thumb of the Babylonians. The author is a myriad of individuals, as most of the groupings are. Many, many prophets, Ezra, Nehemiah, Haggai, Zechariah, Malachi, whoever recorded the book of Esther, which is a really interesting study. And then the length is about 100 years to 120 years, depending on where you put the book of Malachi. It begins with the decree of Cyrus there in Ezra chapter 1. In Ezra chapter 1, there's a cupbearer who happens to be an Israelite. I say happens to be, and I hope you know I mean that as a joke. It's no coincidence that the king's cupbearer, Cyrus, king of Persia, can you imagine? Cyrus, I'm going to say this again, Cyrus, king of Persia, the most powerful man in the world right now, where Nebuchadnezzar was previously, now Cyrus is the most powerful individual in the world. And his cupbearer happens to be an Israelite. And someone who understands the Old Testament, who can do math pretty well, and is smart enough to bring the information concerning the prophecies to his ear. And so Cyrus makes a decree, and it basically says, as the one at the top says, Jews may go home. It's a little more involved than that, but that's pretty much what it says. And the interesting thing, and one of the things we'll talk about moving forward, in the New Testament you have phrases like, when the fullness of time had come. And one of my favorite studies is to see how God had used the kingdoms that had come before to procure certain advantages to the gospel. That the gospel came at exactly the right time, not just when God chose it to come, but it came at the most opportune time for it to be distributed, to be received, for the information to be understood. Because every kingdom leading up to Jesus' time on earth, and inevitably the apostles taking the gospel, and many, many first century, second century, third century Christians taking the gospel in every direction, everything had been set up for that time. And one of the things, one of the most important things for understanding law, something that hadn't been the case before, we saw there, or we will see when we study Daniel more fully, when Darius decrees that if anybody petitions any other god but him, that individual should be thrown into the lion's den. And when it's discovered that Daniel, one of his favorite individuals, is found to be petitioning the God of heaven and earth, and not Darius, that he has to be thrown in the lion's den, and Darius can do nothing about it. Because of the law of the Medes and the Persians do not change. He could write another law, but it could not supersede or get in the way of the law that he had made. The idea was that the law system could not be changed even by the king. Now, if you think about that, and think about the frivolity of law before that, that kings could come and go, they could choose when things should be upheld and when they shouldn't, that you could just whimsically decide when the law should be managed and when it can be fudged on. This changed a lot of things. The Greeks obviously brought a language to the table, a universal language that they made everyone learn. And then the Romans, among other things, secured the roads, made them safe to travel on. It's really interesting to study these things out and to talk about some of the things that go on. But for a cupbearer to happen to be in the king's household, who happens to know about this prophecy and is inclined to mention it to the king, the most powerful man in the world, there's no coincidence. Ezra was there on purpose. And we see that so many times through Scripture, God is pursuing His will through these things, and He accomplishes it exactly how He intended to. It is not hard for God to predict things because He knows what's going to happen. He knows the ends from the beginning. Now, it's hard for me even to predict what my children will do when I have a lot of experience with them. But I'll tell you, God can tell you what they're going to do because He knows for sure what's going to happen. The post-exilic time period ends when the last Old Testament prophet records his message. Because part of that prophecy, part of that message, is that God is fed up dealing with them as a people, and He's not talking to them. I'm not talking to you anymore until I send another prophet. And it's going to be a while, guys. It's going to be, if you look at your time period, about 430 to 450 years before John the Baptist comes. God doesn't talk to them anymore. God is so upset with them. Even after they go into exile for 70 years and they're supposed to learn their lesson, it takes them 100 to 120 years to make God so angry, He won't talk to them anymore. And this is a very patient God. This is one who has invested in them. And it only takes them 100 to 120 years to make Him so angry that He ain't talking to them anymore. He's like, "Hey, you have what you need. You're on your own now. I ain't talking to you anymore." Now, you have some instances where God talks to individuals, obviously, because there's a man at the temple when Jesus is baptized, or when Jesus is circumcised, there we go, when He is committed at the temple, who has been told He will live until the day the Christ, the Messiah, comes, and He will witness the Messiah before He dies. And He rejoices in it. Well, how did He know? But no widespread answers are given to the Israelites. No communication through prophets are given to the Israelites overall. Can you imagine going 450 years not hearing from the Lord? And yet they did. Because they weren't listening to the Lord. You probably had people who did that. I know my mom several times. She decided just to stop talking. And you knew when mom stopped talking, it wasn't good. It wasn't good. Things weren't going well. It's because you weren't listening to her. If we look at the outline of the post-exilic period, as we mentioned before, 538 BC, the decree of Cyrus to return. I say first because this is the first group of people who are allowed to return. They are given credence to return back to Israel. They are also given all of the stuff, as well as lumber and goods. This is something that is flabbergasting to me. I don't understand it. It doesn't make any sense whatsoever why the king, the most powerful man in the world, would allow many of his servants, his citizens, you can't even really call them citizens, they were slaves, let's be fair here. Part of his civilization, he will let them go back home. He will give them the articles of the temple that had been sitting there all this time, made of gold, like solid gold, some of them. He's going to put those in their hands, and then he's going to go ahead and give them even more valuable materials for the rebuilding of the temple. That didn't make any sense at all. For the rebuilding of the wall, for taking care of the things that need taken care of. And yet, when Cyrus decrees this return, part of that decree is not just go home and figure it out. He gives them stuff to take with them. That's insane. That's ridiculous. Who would ever do that? Cyrus. Because that's what God told him to do. And if it hadn't been for God, they wouldn't have left to begin with. So in 536, a man named Zerubbabel, he comes, and with all of this stuff, he begins rebuilding the temple. And in 2 years, the people get so distressed over what is going on around them, of the tribes and the kingdoms that are happening around them, getting angry at them, questioning whether they're supposed to build or not, and being threatening towards them when they're building, that the rebuilding halts. They come home. They get all this stuff and all the articles of the temple. In order to rebuild the temple, the king, the most powerful man in the world, sends them home to go rebuild the temple because, let's be fair, God told them to. And it only takes them 2 years to lose heart. It takes them 2 years. And they spend the next 14 years till 520 BC just standing around, just complaining that they can't build because the people around them are being mean and are telling them they're not supposed to, and they're not sure if they should or not, or if they're going to get in trouble or what's going to happen. Until Haggai and Zechariah come. And Haggai and Zechariah, you should read Haggai and Zechariah, we will, inevitably. And they get on the people. What are you doing? Are we the people of God or not? Are we going to build this thing, or are we just going to stand around and stare at each other? And so they get back to it, and guess what? It only takes them 4 years to finish. So they stood around for 14 years. It only took them 4 years to finish. They could have been done 10 years ago. And that's what Zechariah and Haggai really get on them about. And so they finish the temple. They finish the temple. And about this time, 30 years later, I suppose, 483, most likely to 473, is about the time that Esther becomes queen and saves the Jews from, I almost said Mordecai, that's the wrong name, Haman, here we go, Haman's wicked plot to kill the Jews. What a fantastic story, a fantastic book. And it's not for another 25 or so years that Ezra, again, the namesake of the book. This is the second time Israelites return back to the promised land. And Ezra comes back with a group in order to restore worship. We're going to read a little bit in just a moment about the restoration, not only of the temple, but of the worship. And we're going to see how bad it had gotten in just a minute. And then in 444, Nehemiah comes with a third group of individuals and they rebuild the walls. And that gives them some level of security. Imagine this whole time they've been threatened by individuals outside and around them, groups as well as kingdoms. If you keep building that temple, if you keep building those walls, we're going to come at you. And the people just had to put their nose down. Well, technically half of them put their nose down and worked. And the other half carried swords to make sure that if anything happened, they were ready. And so they got done what needed to get done. And then in about 420, Malachi receives the last of the Old Testament prophecies. Because while they have, over time and through much prodding, done the things that God had called them to do and accomplish, they've also stopped listening to him. They've returned to a place, while they never pick idolatry back up like they did before the exile. So it's like God smacked their hand and they got the idea that they're not supposed to reach into the cookie jar anymore. But now they've started reaching for the brownies instead. So they've learned their lesson, sort of. But they're still not serving the Lord. They're still not dedicated to him. They're still not listening to him. So they don't get into idolatry anymore, but they're messed up into all kinds of other things. And God finally says, enough, I'm done. Basically, it's like, I need you because you're the vehicle by which Jesus is going to come into the world, but I don't have to like you right now. And so I ain't talking to you. I'm not going to talk to you anymore. I wonder sometimes if we reach a place like that. Because we refuse to listen. Because we won't hear what God is telling us. It's 120 years. A lot happens in 120 years, doesn't it? A lot happens. And also not a lot happens in 120 years. Considering it only took them 6 years to build the temple. Considering it only took them, I believe it's 3 years to build the walls. What else did you do with the 100 or so years that you had? Sometimes I wonder that in my life. Sometimes I wonder that about the church that is here today, not just here in Willowdale, but here in America, here in this world. What are we doing with the time we have? And is the Lord really pleased with our efforts? Or are we just keeping time, marching in place? And are we making excuses for the lack of faith and dedication like they did? But Lord, there's all these things going on around us. There's all kinds of opposition. There's all kinds of things happening. There's a reason that we're not doing what you want us to do, that it took us 20 years to build the temple when we could have done it in 6. Why we stood around for 14 years. I wonder sometimes, what will be that call when we get there? Well done, my good and faithful servant, or there was a lot more you could have done. There was a lot more that you should have done. Books that belong in this time period. It's a challenge for the future, I suppose. Books that belong in this time period. Ezra, Nehemiah, Esther, obviously. And then Haggai, Zechariah, and Malachi. Usually it's the minor prophet books that throw us where they belong. But these, because of how they talk about the situations at hand, aren't difficult to place. My favorite section in this is always Jesus in the exile. In Zechariah chapter 2. Zechariah chapter 2. If you pick up in verse 10, I love how this begins. He says, "Sing and rejoice, O daughters of Zion. For behold, I am coming, and I will dwell in your midst, says the Lord. Many nations shall be joined to the Lord in that day, and they shall become my people. And I will dwell in your midst. Then you will know that the Lord of hosts has sent me to you." John chapter 1 and verse 14, "And the Word became flesh and dwelt among us. We beheld his glory, the glory of the only begotten of the Father, full of grace and truth." How many witnessing the things that Jesus was capable of, or the things that Jesus communicated, that he taught, the life that he lived and who he was, they bowed down immediately and said, "My Lord and my God." How many recognized immediately? Maybe not a lot, but some of them definitely, because we have answers from them. Women of ill repute break alabaster flasks over his feet, and they wipe them with their tears, and they dry them with her hair. Because she knew. Because she saw. The Lord was in their midst, and the Lord promises to be in our midst. Do we believe that? Do we trust it? Do we trust that the Lord is with us, even to the end of the age, that he will help us through the difficult times? This time period is a time of rebuilding. And they basically rebuilt Jerusalem. I mean, the place was in squalor before, and so they built a new Jerusalem. And you have something similar. You'll keep your finger here if you want. If you know what's good for you. I don't know. Sounded amusing, so I said it. In John 14, in verse 2, verse 1, he says, "Let not your heart be troubled. You believe in God, believe also in me." That's what we just read in him being in their midst. He says, "In my Father's house are many mansions," or domiciles, dwelling places. "If it were not so, I would have told you. I go to prepare a place for you." In my Father's house are many places to live. There's no shortage of room in our Father's house. There's never going to be somebody who's not let in because there isn't quite enough room. Some might not be let in for other reasons, but never because there isn't enough room for you in our Father's house. And what is that new Jerusalem described there in Revelation 21? Not what is it, but how is it described? That we dwell with Jesus and God the Father. They are the light that is there. They are, their presence illuminates all of that new Jerusalem. What a beautiful imagery, and one that God has prepared for us, that Jesus has been part of preparing for his people. And the hope as we grow in our relationship with God, we've talked about this before, but often, frequently, we start with not wanting to go to hell. And that's a perfectly fine place to start. That's where many of us start. And hopefully over time, we grow into wanting to go to heaven, to be with God. To where our motivation isn't succinctly or distinctly not wanting to go to hell. We still don't want to go to hell. But we move to a place where we appreciate the blessings that God has for us and what are in store for us. And we want to reach for those blessings and we want to live in those blessings, this new Jerusalem. And we have that opportunity in Christ to be His if we follow His will. But we've got to be willing to build through opposition. These Israelites, that's one of their shortcomings. They found any excuse to quit, to stop, even for a time. But what did the Lord bring them back to Israel to do? But to build. But to grow, to develop, not just physically the kingdom, but even themselves, even the priesthood, even to do the things that God had called them to accomplish. In John chapter 2 and verse 19. So He calls them to build, even through opposition. In John chapter 2, not 9, yeah, 19. Verse 19, He says, destroy this temple, and in 3 days I will raise it up. It didn't matter what you did to Jesus, He was going to finish the work. Nothing was going to stop Him, not even death. In fact, that's the funniest thing, isn't it? And that's one of the rewarding things, or I suppose one of the blessings that I've discovered over the years, is the world treats the devil as if he's either impotent or omnipotent. Like, he either doesn't have any power and doesn't exist, or he has all the power. Well, we know certainly he doesn't have all the power, only God has that. But more importantly, he doesn't know everything either, because if he did, he wouldn't have killed Jesus. He was one of the premier individuals pushing for Jesus' death. And yet that death itself was what destroyed him. And that tells me that while he might be crafty and he might know a lot about us in general, he might have had a lot of practice and is not someone to be trifled with, he does not know everything. He's still got problems. And his biggest problem is that he doesn't serve the Lord, and we do. And the book of Revelation, of all things, teaches one thing, most assuredly. And when we study the book of Revelation, this is what I hope you get out of it. If you get nothing else, the Lord's people win. The battle's done. Right? The war is over. The only thing left is to decide which side you're on. That's it. And that's the whole of the book of Revelation, is communicating that one thought. This whole thing's been settled. The only thing left is for you to decide whose side you'll fall on. Will it be the Lord's? Or will it be the devil's? Because it's your choice. The onus is on you to decide. And that might be the scariest thing of all. And that was oftentimes the scariest thing for them. They would look back and they would say, well, we're only 50-some years from captivity. What are we supposed to do? What did the people say when they were 2 years from captivity? They started building the temple. That's what they did. They got home. You know what they did? They started building the temple. And when things got rough, some of them kept going, and others quit. But they should have kept going, and we need to keep going. In Nehemiah 13, John chapter 2 also contains this remarkable passage about Jesus casting out the people who are making profit at the distress of their brethren, people who are changing monies at their own advantage or are selling products in what is most likely the area of the Gentiles, places that no one thought was important, and Jesus throws them out. He makes a whip of cords and he cleanses the temple. Well, in Nehemiah, I know I forgot to leave my finger there. I told you, leave it in Zechariah. In Nehemiah 13 and verse 7, look at this. He says, I love this. And I came to Jerusalem, right? So Nehemiah comes to Jerusalem. Verse 7, he says, and I came to Jerusalem and discovered the evil that Eliashib had done for Tobiah in preparing a room for him in the courts of the house of God. I want you to think about that for a second. So the temple, right? The temple is there, and there's areas of it that are dedicated for various things. And one individual has decided that a portion of that area should be reserved for a person. and his household goods. He gets to live in the temple. Who lives in the temple? Who belongs in the temple? God. God belongs. This is God's tabernacle. This is God's dwelling place. This is a place where he dwells in a way where he dwells nowhere else. And look at verse 8. He says, "And it grieved me bitterly." Jesus had righteous indignation when he cast the individuals out of the temple, when he overturned tables and he ran the people out. He wasn't angry that they had hurt his name. They were angry that they had thrown aspersions at his Father's name, that they had treated the house of God as a den of iniquity or den of thieves. "And it grieved me bitterly," he says. "Therefore, I threw all the household goods of Tobiah out of the room. And then I commanded them to cleanse the room, and I brought back into the articles of the house of God with the grain offering and the frankincense. And I realized that the portions of the Levites had not been given them, for each of the Levites and the singers who did the work had gone back to his field." So there were individuals that were supposed to be doing their job inside the temple to praise and glorify God. They were not being paid as they were supposed to be by the old law, and so they had had to go home in order to survive. That's how bad it had gotten. That the people who were supposed to be doing their job weren't able to do their job because some knuckleheads were in there doing something they weren't supposed to be doing. And he comes in and he's like, "I can't believe you're doing this." And he yells at them. And he throws this guy's stuff out. It's almost like, you know, like when your wife gets angry and throws all your stuff in the yard. Not that I know that personally. But I see it on TV, so I guess it's a thing. That's what this guy did. He grabbed all this dude's stuff and he threw it out. He's like, "I guess you're not supposed to be in here. Get out of here." And that's what should have happened. How many people should have stood in the way of this? And they all just stood there and watched it happen. And these Levites, they went home because they weren't being paid. And Nehemiah's like, "I get it, guys. I get it. So I contended with the rulers." This is what he does. He goes all the way to the top. He says, "I contended with the rulers and said, 'Why is the house of God forsaken?'" Can you imagine asking the leaders of Israel that? To have the gumption to just walk in and go, "Are you guys kidding me? Do you not know what the house of the Lord is? You just let some random dude abide in it for a time? Keep his junk in there? Get out of here." "And I gathered them together and I set them in their place." I wonder if that's where it came from. "I told them what for. I said, 'You guys need to handle this. I got you started. Now finish the work and get back to business.'" And what did Jesus say there in John 2? Oh, well, what did he effectively lead them towards? Get back to what you're supposed to be about. Get back to doing my Father's business. In Zechariah 3 and verse 8, 6 and verse 12, he references the branch, which is an interesting reference. It actually references back to being a branch of the tree of Jesse. It connects Jesus with David, the king, and his kingly line, but through Jesse, which is an interesting connection because Jesse was never king. But part of that is there in John 15, where Jesus says, "I am the vine, and you are the branches." That the one who abides in me has life, and the ones who don't do not have life. What happens to the one, what happens to the branch that is not in Christ? It gets cut off. The one who doesn't produce fruit, it gets removed, and it gets tossed into the fire. But even the branch that does produce fruit, what happens? It gets pruned. Because the Lord loves us, he helps us to do better than we would have done on our own. He challenges us, he corrects us, Hebrews chapter 12. Because we are part of the branch. Because we are connected to this branch that goes further back than David or Jesse even, but back. What did Jesus say himself? "Before Abraham was, I am." That in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. The same was with God in the beginning. That he is the source of life. And if we're tied to that branch, we will bear fruit. And in Zechariah chapter 9, I told you to stay there. I didn't listen. There we go. That didn't take long. Some of these minor prophets, I tell you, finding them is tough. They're not very big. Thankfully, Zechariah is quite a few chapters. Zechariah 9, look at verse 9. He says, "Rejoice greatly, O daughter of Zion. Shout, O daughter of Jerusalem. Behold, your king is coming to you. He is just and having salvation, but not how you would expect. Not on a war horse, lowly and riding on a donkey, a colt, the foal of a donkey." Not even a full-fledged donkey. A juvenile donkey. He's going to come in on a donkey's colt. A young donkey. He doesn't even get a full-fledged donkey. He doesn't get a full-grown one. He doesn't get a war horse. He comes in a humble way. And what did the Israelites do that day? He comes riding in, not on a war horse as they had expected, but he comes riding in nonetheless. And how many were standing there? They call it Palm Sunday, because it happened to be the first day of the week that he rides in. And they lay down the palm branches before him like a king. But how many of them meant that? Jesus had something to say about that. John chapter 7, or Matthew chapter 7, verse 21. "Not all who say to me, Lord, Lord, shall enter the kingdom of heaven, but he who does the will of my Father, which is in heaven." We talked this morning about the importance of obedience. That if we love him, we would keep his commandments. And I can't tell you how important that is. Obviously, it's super important. Jesus not only says that, but it gets picked up numerous times through the New Testament, through the New Testament writers, that a love for him is in truth a love for yourself. It's weird how that selfishness of wanting to go to heaven and not wanting to go to hell comes through also in serving Christ. It's the best thing you can do. And hopefully we grow into doing it because we love God. But not wanting to go to hell is a fine place to start. That's sometimes the motivation we need to get on the right track. "Lord, I don't want to go to hell. Help me avoid that fate." And the Lord said, "Done. I've got a path for you. It's through the Christ, the Son of God." John chapter 14 and verse 6. He says, "I am the way, the truth, and the life. No man comes to the Father except through me." That branch of life is how we come to the Lord, how we come to the Father of love, of light. It is how we access salvation, and it is the only path that we have to reaching heaven. And if you today need to take that path, it is probably a big detour from your life current. And that's okay, because your life current is headed in the wrong direction. If you're not in Christ, you're going the wrong way, and you need to turn around. And that's repentance, friends. You need to recognize that you're headed in the wrong direction and you need to turn around. And that's what these Israelites needed to see. And many prophets are sent to them. "Hey guys, you're going the wrong direction. Let's turn around." And sometimes they listen. Frequently, they don't. Which is why God doesn't talk to them for 420 years. Are you going to be one who doesn't listen? You might be. But I hope you do. And I hope you will hear the message of the New Testament, the hope, and the grace that God has purchased with his son's blood, that branch of Jesse, that hope that we have of a new Jerusalem. Because that's what we're doing right now, friends. We're rebuilding the kingdom. And we're doing it brick by brick. It's the only way we can. We add folks to the church. We bring them to the king. And he makes them whole. And he adds them to the church. And as such, we gain brothers and sisters. And if you have fallen away from him, you've left the faith, you can do that while sitting in these pews. I'll tell you, it's happened time and time again. That we can still sit here while we are not right with him. And you can play the part and you can show every good thing. But if your heart is not his, if your life does not belong to him, then that needs to change. And we would love to help you change it, to make your life right with him. And if you need to stay his and you're struggling, you're not alone. We all struggle remaining on the path. That's why he gave us a family, so that we could challenge each other when we get off the path, and we could help each other while we're on it together, that we could work together so that we all make it to that hope one day of heaven. And if we can help you today to put your life right with him initially, or to come back to him, or to stay strong in his path, whatever we can help you with, I pray that you let us know as together we stand and sing.